second episode of Does Your Favorite Song Suck, where we revisit great songs from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. I am your host, Spencer Owen, and this is the first Kale and Egan free episode of Does Your Favorite Song Suck, because as producer, he has decided... And I'm going to trust him that me and my guest are in plenty of entertainment and expertise for this particular moment. And I have to say that I think that's absolutely correct and may be an informed decision based on the song we're going to be talking about, which my guest has no idea what it is.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
My guest is a good, great friend of mine who... Also, I was in a band with for a number of years.
True.
You're just going to take good? You're not going to take the great part? You're going to go with the first one, not the second one?
Well, it was your first instinct.
That's a good point. We are talking to Fletcher Tucker.
Tis I.
Fletcher Tucker is here. He has a new album that I actually, full disclosure, contributed to on a small amount.
That's true. Well, small's not so small to me.
The small as in, like, you know, there's a bunch of sound on the album, and, like, I contributed, like,
yeah, that's
a couple things on a few minutes of it. So,
that's
like,
true.
That's really what I meant by
you
small.
Actually contributed less than actual crickets in terms of just sounds on the album.
Yeah. No, crickets
there are
take,
way more crickets.
Crickets
involved.
Take precedence.
Yeah.
However, I think that's totally...
There are more owls. You contribute the exact same amount as an actual coyote.
However, I think that's completely valid.
But it was great. They were great.
Yeah, and you should listen to it. It's called Cold Spring. It's the best album by this person, Fletcher
you.
Tucker. We used to be in a band called
Bird. Six.
We used to be in a band called Bird by Snow, and true. I'm very proud of what we made together.
Thank you.
But I think that Fletcher has now unleashed himself to great heights.
I feel unleashed. I'm gonna mince words.
But I think
I've unleashed myself. I think that you said it. I actually heard you say it, and it was recorded.
Yeah. So you think I said it?
So you definitely said it, and I agree with it.
Good.
Yeah.
God, we're so on the same page about literally
unmissed.
Everything.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Mr. Spencer Owen.
I think that what we should probably just do is start talking about... I got into Prince after Fletcher did.
That's true.
I had friends who were way into Prince. Fletcher is one of a couple friends of mine who was super into Prince. And... His passion for Prince was palpable, and I wanted it to be infectious. I liked everything I heard by Prince, basically, in my life. But it didn't really speak to me early on, like during college when we first met and knew each other.
Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I really don't know. I was already getting into other R&B music. Like, I was definitely not... shielding myself from that kind of influence or interest. So I don't know what it is about Prince that took me kind of a long time, but it took me a while.
He's a mature artist.
That might actually be it.
He was a mature artist.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
He still is one, but he isn't alive as one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, teenagers wouldn't love his music, depending.
Yeah.
But I think that for me, I didn't respond so much to what he was offering until I had properly matured, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
and now at this point, I would consider him, and I think I've said this on both the pilot and first episode of this show, he is my favorite musical artist of all time.
Wow.
I no other musician speaks to my kind of like id and my all the other parts of the Freudian psyche at the same time the way he does. And the musically speaking, he also is the fact that he's a complete polymath who has incredible sensitivity in his musical choices while also being incredibly prolific and bold and fearless at the same time. I aspire to all those things as a performer and musician, and I feel like that Prince helped me realize that. Like, I think it was there before I fully fell in love with Prince, and it multiplied tenfold once I start really started getting into him.
Well, that might be the weirdest thing about me and these other unnamed people potentially.
It's like what
introducing you to Prince, or not introducing you, but giving, I don't know, maybe giving you permission to investigate Prince or something. Is that that's like there obviously is like a kind of a Prince within you, you know, like a little Prince somewhere in there. Not the kind that is on
not
French
the
planets,
yes,
but
exactly.
But you know, a small symboled man.
The symbol is sort of like there's like a version of the symbol that's like kind of like tattooed behind my
yeah,
left ear.
Exactly, in like a ultraviolet ink that
that's right.
Like you can see at like Blacklight Bowling or something.
And then one day I went into the bathroom at Blacklight Bowling and I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, right. It's on your earlobe.
Yeah,
it's, yeah. It's
it was
like
there
daintily,
the whole time.
It's the tiniest tattoo daintily inscribed upon your earlobe.
I want to know.
Yeah. So that's weird.
But
like,
I want
to
know
what was that like to uncover the man who is part of you.
It was
later
just,
in life.
It was just breathtaking, and what did it for me was, all the songs that he never released. I started to like once I got into Dirty Mind, and then a bunch of the other '80s albums. I was pretty in, but then it occurred to me that like using pirating software, you could download all these bootlegs of songs that he had never released.
Well, and that's interesting because Prince is. I mean, he's so successful and so popular, but he's so much weirder and more, I think, more creative than he is, than you can understand just by accessing his, like, popular catalog. So when you do the deep dive into, like, the stuff that he's just, like, recording in his bathroom or whatever and, like, multi-tracking and, like, doing bizarro sketch comedy on top of in addition to just making like just the most outsider like funk music that you could ever imagine, it really unlocks a totally new dimension to his music, right?
I completely agree with that. They just released a reissue of Purple Rain that was supposed to come out for the I think 25th or 30th anniversary of the album. Didn't happen in a classic Prince fashion. But it came out after he died.
You ain't releasing that.
He had to die for it to come out,
right.
Basically.
Oh,
but it came out, and it came with a second disc that would never have been on there.
Oh, interesting.
If he had been alive, which is a disc of tracks that they call From the Vault. So his stash is called
because he saved everything.
Yeah, and
he recorded everything.
And it's called The Vault. Like that's the phrase. The Vault is like in music circles, give me a fucking word. the phrase The Vault can
in
mean a lot of things in a lot of contexts.
In the rhombi of musi.
If you're talking about pop music, like you might say The Vault and people usually think of Prince because he's the one with the vault of unreleased songs that you've never heard. And
like thousands of them.
Yeah. And like on this reissue, there's a disc of 11 tracks, just 11 songs. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, the 11 tracks take up 79 minutes of an 80-minute CD.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how he worked a lot of the time when he was unfettered and not limited to
just endless
trying to make record albums. And
hi, this is Caleb, very quickly. Why
where did he come from?
Where
is he?
Why doesn't he? Why would he not want that released? I don't know enough about Prince to know why he's trying to keep that from the public.
He tightly controlled his image. He did so in a very, very personal way. Like he just his image was like he released a bootleg, not bootleg, but he released a 4-disc set of outtakes and previously unreleased songs called Crystal Ball. And he tried to get the fan input on this thing because he knew his fans had heard a lot of these unreleased songs.
Right.
So he reached out to his fan club, and he always had a fan club, even when it was totally out of style to have a fan club. He always had one. And he would reach out to these people and say, I know you've heard all these songs. Mm-hmm. Which ones do you want me to release? And he asked. And they told him, and then he released something that didn't match their requests in almost any way, shape, or form.
Right, because no one's opinion matters but his own.
That's completely
true. And that's always been true. And
wow.
And like I should
probably
say,
probably is true now. Probably is true.
I should say that
whatever
it,
dimension he lives in.
Yeah. No, I should say that box set, the Crystal Ball box set that came out, also had a number of songs that people had been clamoring for him to finally release.
But they happened to just overlap in the mandorla of Prince's needs and their needs.
Precisely. Yeah. It's not because they wanted it. It's because he wanted to. Yeah. So anyway, he tried,
right.
And then it just turned out it was all because of his image, and his vision was more important.
And his image, like, I mean, just to sort of play off of that, it's just my own take on him, which isn't like grounded in historical. I don't know. I mean, I have a feeling there's like many tomes written about Prince that I have no relationship to. I just relating to him strictly based on the music.
Mm-hmm.
I really think of him as like an outsider musician that was so brilliant in his powers, not only as a musician, but his powers of like artistic persona, holographic generating, that he could just be an outsider musician who just convinced everybody in the universe that he was like a rock star.
Oh yeah.
And a pop star. And he has the chops to do it, but like he's I don't know. It's a little hard to express.
He opened for the Rolling Stones in the early 80s.
Right.
In Los Angeles, before he had released, I think he was doing Controversy at that time, the Controversy tour or something like that. And he was opening for them, and they were all wearing underwear on stage, and he was playing some of his best songs he ever wrote.
Wait, who's they?
The Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
He was already playing some of his best songs he'd ever written because he was so prolific that, you know, and so good right out the gate that like three albums in, he was already a master.
Right.
And he's recorded medium.
And he's what, like 23? Or?
Yeah. Super young. And they got booed off the stage.
Wow.
And stuff thrown at them.
That's crazy.
Because he just had so much to offer in a popular music sense, and so much to offer in a personal, don't give a fuck, what will you do about this kind of sense, that often clashed. And it was totally like the tension that drove his entire career, I'd say. Anyway, we're almost about to talk about the song we're going to go through.
Okay.
But the disc
it's a Sheila E. song, clearly.
Written and produced by Prince. As almost all of them are. On this bonus disc that's just like 11 minutes of unreleased, or 11 tracks of unreleased material that's like 80 minutes long.
Yeah.
You listen to Purple Rain and you're like, this is like a calculated recording for someone like Prince. Like, relatively speaking, it's a good album, but it's a relatively calculated record album. The disc of unreleased material on the Purple Rain bonus, you know, on the box set is overwhelming to listen to because it's all this stuff in its high quality as it's ever sounded. And it's to use a word that I previously applied to Fletcher Tucker, unleashed. It's Prince unleashed. It's like the unfettered, unguarded, everything. It's just him. It's just
there's
him
a
pure.
There's a pull quote in this where Spencer says that Prince and I are the same. I'm really
if you want to find it without reordering any of the words, I absolutely encourage you to use it.
Okay, great.
Anyway, it's so overwhelming to listen to that.
Is that what we're listening to?
We're definitely going to listen to his most popular song of all time.
Okay.
Which is called When Doves Cry.
Okay. Yes.
We just learned by looking this up randomly in
His most popular song of all time.
I think so.
Yeah.
We just learned looking this up by choosing it randomly
that's insane.
It was the number one popular song of 1984. It was the most popular song of 1984 by anyone, according to Billboard.
Okay.
It was it. That there was no other, and we thought it was going to be Michael.
It was the most popular of anyone.
They had a Hot 100 chart each week.
Okay.
And on the Hot 100, they're just measuring radio airplay and single sales.
Mm-hmm.
So, combining that detail, that information, they can measure the popularity of the song. And the song When Doves Cry must have been at number one the most of any of the songs that year, which made it number one
of the year.
Combined with all of its other chart positions throughout the year, that made it the number one most popular song of the entire year of 1984. Okay. So we thought it was going to be Michael Jackson, but I think we were sort of a year ahead because Thriller had already come out in probably, you know, the top five or 10 probably the top five or 10 of 1983 was songs from from Thriller.
I think there could be and probably is an entire podcast that would just be about like the odd polarities of Michael Jackson and Prince and their like,
oh my God, Michael Jackson was driven by competition with Prince his entire life.
Right.
And that once Prince obviously came out. Right. And then even before
Prince picked up his first sousaphone.
They knew.
Yeah.
They knew they would be rivals forever. Yeah. But Prince did not consider Michael Jackson a rival at all.
Well, Prince didn't consider anyone a rival.
Nope.
There is no one who can rival Prince.
Completely.
Yeah.
And Prince there's a lot
his own, totally own, he lived on his own plane of existence and everyone was beneath that plane.
I mean, there's got to be something to,
and he wasn't wrong.
Michael Jackson was the king of pop, right? And
was Prince ever called the king of anything?
No.
The prince of anything?
No.
The
he was
baron
just, he just
of
was
anything?
Prince.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson
was a prince.
Called himself the king of pop and named a child Prince.
Oh. Weird.
Such a psychotic, like, weird relationship he had with Prince. Anyway.
But also a blanket. He named one after
he
a blanket.
He did also after a blanket.
So, a little hard to look into the...
He was a strange fellow. Prince was also a strange fellow, and we're going to listen to his most popular song, When Doves Cry. Fletcher, when do you remember ever listening to Prince before you decided you loved him? And then what happened to make you fall in love with him?
It's a good question, Spencer. I was just I was thinking about it. I was using a little bit of my brain to think about it while we listened to the song. And so I do have a memory of I love the Muppets. Okay. So I love all the original Muppet movies and I love the original Muppet show.
Mm-hmm.
I loved them, from a very early age. And in the early 90s, there was a reboot of the Muppet show.
Muppets Tonight.
Prince was a guest on Muppets Tonight.
That's right. He did,
Starfish and Coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which to this day is one of my very favorite Prince songs, and in a great tradition of artists co-hosting the Muppets with Kermit and the gang, you know, Paul Simon and most notably in the original Muppet Show, I think.
Yeah,
but also one of my deep musical heroes, interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember watching it and thinking like, this guy's pretty funny and weird, like, you know. And I don't remember, I think he was wearing like some kind of like fishnet sweater or something, or and like a,
I think that's right,
a pink, you know, a neon pink like tank top under it or something, you know.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, for a little kid on the Central Coast in the 90s, like that was something new. I was like, oh, that's pretty wild, this guy. Like, he kind of almost seemed like he existed in the Muppet world or something, you know. But I definitely remember my dad saying, oh that guy Prince, he's supposed to be like a musical genius, And my dad, like, not really knowing about Prince, certainly, and yeah. not caring much about music other than like classic rock that he like grew up with, yeah. you know, but him just being, oh, that guy's supposed to be a musical genius. And I definitely remember that resonate, that kind of reverberates in my head somehow. And then when did I come into like full going into more of like a deep dive? It must have been when I was like around 16 years old. I got a turntable and I started buying records at the local record shop, Recycled Records, almost exclusively based on record covers.
Yeah.
And buying them mostly out of like the $1 or $2 bins. And pretty sure that Purple Rain is the first Prince record I picked up out of the bin.
Wouldn't surprise me. It's because it's his top seller.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be in the bargain.
It's going to be available for $1 or $2, yeah. you know, especially in, you know, what would that be, like 1998 or something like that?
Yeah.
And liking it. Not it being like what, you know, being like just sort of impressed with it on like a sonic level, you know, having already become like deeply invested in like the Beatles and the Beach Boys and like early to, you know, the 20th century. I mean, you know, 60s early interesting recording techniques, you
know,
and like for sure not resonating with like just sort of it's like sexuality or anything like that, but just being like, wow, this sounds fascinating.
It definitely, you know, stands outside of the 80s, even though it's very much of the
80s. Right.
It couldn't really be from any other time, but it doesn't sound like other things from that time. It only sounds more like itself than like other things from the time.
Yeah. So then sometime, like maybe a couple, I think I was probably, it was probably a couple of years later, I was like 18 or something. That's when I got For You, which is Prince's first album, actually.
The first one.
And it's the most stripped down of his albums. He is totally recorded at home. He plays all the instruments.
Yes, he does, yes.
And it was, and it's the most, I think it was recorded at home. Was it not recorded at home?
Well, I think, no, because I think you're thinking of Dirty Mind for that one. Dirty Mind was just recorded at home.
Oh, okay.
For You is in the studio, but it was definitely...
But it's more, it's got a more lo-fi vibe than the other ones in some respect. Maybe it's just because the budget was lower.
I think, I think he just went into the studio as like, you know, let's give this guy a try. He's never had a hit. He is a wunderkind.
Right.
He's a total madman.
Right.
He can do everything. Let's see what he does with everything.
Right.
Let's just put him in a studio and he's got a record deal off this, just off that. He had not had a hit. He had not had a single.
Right. Right. Totally.
But he just showed up.
Yeah. So, and I also think that in a lot of ways, that's his most rock album from at least early album. I'm not familiar with all the massive later catalog, but just like, it just resonated with me as just like, something about its simplicity and its kind of its connection more to sort of more like rock music or like, you know, early 60s rock music, and just in terms of its whatever, I don't know, guitar solos or something.
The guitar solos are on For You are actually, I think, my favorite Prince guitar solos.
Well, I actually think I think lists like the list I'm about to even fictionally create are stupid.
Yeah.
Totally stupid. But I would, if I was forced to make like a top 10 greatest guitarists list, he would be in the list and very high up simply for his guitar ability. But even to just refer to him or think of him as a guitarist is a gross underestimation of his abilities. But so that album was also the first album where like, of his that I had, they were like in the liner notes, it just explicitly says, honestly, because I was getting these bargain records, it might have been the first Prince record I had that had liner notes at all.
Yeah.
But it says like he plays all the instruments. It freaking blew my mind.
I just have to clarify, it doesn't just say Prince plays all the instruments.
Okay.
It has the list of the songs.
Yeah.
And then under each song, you know how, like, when you're looking at liner notes, it credits the person that played it and then colon and then what instruments they played? Right. It goes like the first song, and then it says Prince colon list of, and then the list of all the instruments in the song.
Right.
And it does that for every single song on the album.
Right. So yeah. So it was meant. was meant to communicate a kind of grandiosity, and it succeeded because I was like, okay, now I need to really know what the hell is going on here.
And I think that that combined with what your dad said is a perfect way to illustrate how a lot of people sort of feel about Prince and why his personality and abilities were as much the story as his music. And I think that like your dad's saying like, oh, I've heard he's like a musical genius.
Right, I've heard that.
To me, that is so crucial to understanding Prince's popularity and what Prince managed to communicate with like a song like When Doves Cry. Mm-hmm. When Doves Cry, as a 3.5 minute, I should mention, we listened to the song twice. We listened to the radio edit first, the video/radio edit, and then we listened to the 5+ minute version from the album. But in both versions, especially the album version, he takes this song that is such a core, like as a hook, as a series of hooks, it is a brilliant, catchy, wonderful pop song. It speaks for itself as a pop song.
Right.
But that was not in any stretch of the imagination enough for Prince to allow this song he wrote to just speak for itself.
He
doesn't want that. He never wants that.
Yeah, totally.
And what he does with it instead is what he wants to communicate, in my estimation of listening to When Doves Cry closely, is I'm sort of also paraphrasing from like both of your guys, your and Kaylin's observations as we were listening too, but like, it's kind of like, I'm doing this for me. This is what I do. I want to do this. That's why it sounds like this.
Right.
But also, as Kaylin put it, this is sexy and I'm sexy. And isn't that interesting to you? Like, you're going to want to respond.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll just to say what I was thinking is that he's doing insane things.
Yeah.
Sound like an insane person.
Yeah.
And somebody who is sort of, my natural instinct would be to attribute those insane decisions to a sort of quiet artist in the corner who's like, you know, I know I'm not going to sell many records, but like, I'm weird and this is my weird thing.
Yeah.
But he also couples that with the feeling of like, no, fuck you. You also want to fuck me.
Right.
Yeah, I don't care how weird I'm being.
You
love it.
Totally. And he does that. And he outwardly projected that too. I mean, he came up with that fucking like wearing high heels and, you know, whatever you think of as Prince, like, that's his. Yeah. Like, he didn't copy that from anybody. And everybody just ate it up. They lapped it up.
Yeah.
And I mean, does anybody know what the hell makes that possible? I don't. It is a true mystery. But
I mean,
once in a while, the magical imagination of a true, like, introverted genius collides with, like, the incredible sexual magnetism of like an extroverted, like, you know, rock star, or like
rock star is it
for yeah sure. He's a rock star. I can't honestly think of a second example, but it happened with him somehow.
I've always called him
Elvis, maybe. Like, Elvis was an oddball who sort of liked to hide away, but
it was a different thing
because he didn't seem to chase it in the same way.
No.
And he didn't have the phenomenal creativity that we're talking about.
I think that Prince is the most deserving superstar I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think
he might be the only one.
And it's amazing how he shows it off. Like, we were just talking about how, or we were listening to the song, and we were reacting in real time to the opening of the song. And the song, the first thing you hear is an insane, like, harmonized, like, you know, with like through a harmonizer pedal guitar solo that has no context.
He starts with a guitar solo.
Thing you hear is a guitar soloing as if it was happening in the middle of a song. That's the first thing you hear.
Not just as if it was happening in the middle of the most epic song that had ever been recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the first sound you hear, and you hear it by itself.
Right. Well, can I ask a weird question? And my memory of Purple Rain is failing me right now, but this is the last
song. The album
song
or the movie?
In the film?
No, it's not.
It's
in the middle of the movie.
It's in the middle of the movie.
And it's in the middle of the album as well.
Because listening to it, what's funny about it is it sounds... in Medea Res. It sounds like it begins in the sense of, like, you know, we've already arrived. It's almost like the way that it starts, and I wish you could speak to this. It feels like you're coming out of something, and it almost feels like it's going to be a 40-second sting of a thing. It's like, mm-hmm. whether it's a montage sequence mm-hmm. or the finale of a movie, it's like, we've done all the hard work here, so now we're just going to give you kind of a good time. And what's crazy is he keeps one-upping that
yeah.
until mm-hmm. it becomes its own masterpiece. Like yeah. that's, mm-hmm. but it's a very odd way to begin.
It's super weird. It is the first song on the second side of Purple Rain.
Okay, well, that's a really important, just in terms of like sequencing of a record.
Yeah,
in the way that some people still think of records, and I mean, I do, and
I do too.
And that's incredibly important. The flip, the first song on the second side, is. Maybe the most important song on this. It's at least the second most important song on the record.
Yeah, I think that with when you have a culture that is, it's record based at this point.
Right.
Like 1984 is like
completely
almost the peak of like there's getting too, cassette but, out cassettes out, but
it's the same format.
Yeah,
the cassette flip is going to be just as important.
And the needle drop on the song, both as a single and mm-hmm. as a, and he was like a 12-inch single guy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The needle drop on the first moment of the song is so important and so crucial. And so you hear that guitar going nuts, and then you hear the beat come in, his programmed beat,
right
away. And then I believe the third sound you hear is him making this noise. In a rhythmic, like convulsive way, like,
yeah, like it's like a car alarm with asthma. Or something.
But like it's sort of like a car alarm with asthma, but it's also sort of like autoerotic asphyxiation,
yeah.
where it's just like he's just
yep.
like what you have to understand immediately.
It's sensual,
is
weirdly
there
sensual.
Is the most passion that you've ever heard happening to you right now, just and you haven't heard 15 seconds of the song and nothing's happened. Well, the song hasn't happened yet.
Okay, so passion is a good word, but like we also, I don't know, it's also possible to sort of frame up that sound and some of the other things he does with intimacy, or like a projection yeah. of intimacy, because what, back to what Caelan was saying about like I am this weird and you love it.
Yeah.
And like he really, you know, he's okay with exposing that because he has the strangest level of confidence imaginable, which is extra strange because usually it's just a delusional narcissist who has this level of confidence and nobody actually likes them, you know? But like in this case, it's like the most fantastic, the most wonderfully fantastic and pop musician has that level of confidence, and he can make grunting noises that endear him to the listener and also make you want to lean in and be like, what is he doing?
Yes,
I'm interested in it. Maybe it turns me on. I can't tell. I think it's supposed to.
Yeah.
So that's, right. that's good enough for me.
Yeah. It's,
you know?
Great. It's
like,
it's,
I'll follow your lead, Prince. I guess this shit's supposed to turn me on. So maybe it does.
His band.
I don't know myself as well as you know yourself. So I'm just going to rely on you, man.
The people in his band always had this relationship with him uh-huh. where they were like,
God,
I
would not want to be in his band.
No, but they were drawn to his. It's not like they were just having a job.
Right.
No one in his band ever just had a job. They were drawn to what he was doing.
Right.
They were fully, especially the Revolution at this time. And I should mention once again, if I haven't already, actually, that this the only instrumentalist and vocalist on this song is Prince.
Right.
There isn't any other people. Aren't any other people on the song? Even though it's on the Prince and the Revolution album, Purple Rain, and the Revolution does play live on a number of the songs on Purple Rain. Including the song Purple Rain.
I wonder how many manifestations this song has.
I don't know if it has very many. That's not really how it worked. He worked is he would go into the studio with a professional engineer.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in his life, this is what he would do. Mm-hmm. He would go into the studio with Susan Rogers, his professional engineer,
mm-hmm.
and he would start turning stuff on recording it.
At the time...
Usually the beat first.
At the time, kind of unusual to have like a woman for a professional engineer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very unusual. He had a lot of female collaborators there.
Right.
Which is also pretty unusual
yeah.
for a male pop or rock star.
Right. I mean, kind of unusual for a female one too, really.
It's true. Yeah. Actually, maybe more unusual.
Yeah.
For a female.
Yeah.
but I would say that, yes, he would just go in there and start laying stuff down just like this, like because the song was in his head, he would start laying it down. And, you know, you can, as you listen to When Doves Cry, you can hear there's little moments of harmonized singing that were inevitably done because, or, you know, undoubtedly, I should say, done because he riffed something on one take. And then he's like, oh, that's good. And then he just effortlessly laid four harmonies on top of it later to fit the tonality of the song perfectly.
Right.
And in terms of iterations, actually, famously, the only other iteration of this song that existed, and this is really just a mixing decision more than anything, is that it did have a bass line at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just cut it. He just took it out.
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe just not that interesting to just like broadly speculate on mics, but I'm curious, just as someone that likes to arrange and record music, just what... Like, I wonder if he was carving things away to get to this level of minimalism, or if he started with this level of minimalism and just decided it was good enough and didn't want to keep building, or because can you think of another pop song that is mostly drums or drum-like synthesizers?
Can you think
singing?
Of another number one pop song?
Oh, well,
like
yeah,
the popularity of this, hearing it again, is
crazy.
What really blows
it's
my mind.
Boggling,
like it's beautiful and incredible and a work of genius.
Yeah.
But what the fuck happened that this was the most popular song? Of the entire year.
It's so strange. It's so strange. But it's only strange because the song itself is not odd.
You mean the melody?
Yeah.
The main melody.
The lyrics are a little weird.
The lyrics are a bit weird, but you can kind of get to it. You kind of know what he's talking
about.
It's
like soul imagery. He uses psychedelic imagery a lot of the time. Yeah. So like he's kind of getting at it from that angle. But I think that
it's basically talking about like not being able to have a relationship.
Yes.
Work.
Completely.
Right. Which is pretty relatable.
Totally.
And the melody is undeniably beautiful. And the rhythm is visceral and makes, you know, like I challenge anyone not to move their body to it.
Yes.
You know, so.
But the sounds of like, there's like a flanger effect on the beat that just comes in at the right amount. It's like that boom, boom, that
and
noise.
It almost, it turns the beat into a, like a semi-melodic form also.
100%.
Like you get like some new tonality to it that makes it,
He was famous for using the Lynn drum machine, which is the drum machine that's on this and many of his early recordings, to compose the beat for a song. And then as part of the composition, he would tune the sounds by lowering or raising the bit rate on the sample.
Interesting.
So that it could, like, the Lynn drum sound just sounds like normally.
Right.
But he made it sound like... Like that was him lowering the pitch of the drum, and that is the Prince drum sound. Just because he decided, like that was a thing that machine could do, and he was just like, it doesn't sound right unless I do this with it, and then it sounded like a new tonal element to the song.
Right. Interesting.
It's a fully like the production is part of the composition for him.
Oh, totally.
That why you think he felt it was okay to delete a bass line? Because
I think
he felt like that was carrying it?
I think that's a big part of it, but I think another big part of it is that the chords of the song are actually there, and maybe this is just because I've heard it so many times that I can hear what they are, like from the very beginning, what the chord progression is, even when he's just singing over drums, but or beats. But the chord progression is evident from just the melody.
Right.
And that's pretty rare for a simple pop melody like this one. But it's just the chord progression he chose. He figured out that if he took away, even without like, you know, chording behind the song, which there almost never is, chording behind the song.
Is there ever?
Only in like the harmonies.
Okay.
But no chording instruments.
And there's like a kind of like a wash of like synth.
Oh, the synth pad kind of brings in the chording
towards the end.
Yeah. But like for the verses of the song, the part where everyone's going to be listening, that's the part where there's no chording at all, and you can hear the progression in his singing, without, and he's not singing it. It's just there. It's Ghost. It's a Ghost chord progression.
Right.
But you can hear it. You can understand. You can follow where it's going.
Well, which is, I think, something that I think there's something very like beguiling about that. You know, and he's, you know, he's a male witch. You know, I mean, he's a. I don't want to call him a wizard. I want to call him a male witch.
Warlock?
Like that's what I think.
Isn't that what a warlock is?
No,
I don't
maybe.
Really know fantasy. But I
you
just
could call
that's
him that. But
was.
I'm going to say male witch because it's better for
it
his
outfits.
It
sounds better.
Warlock makes it sound like he'd like be wearing cloaks and things.
Sorry.
But and like yeah, and have a shriveled head. I don't know. But one shriveled arm maybe. Like there's something that happens when there's an implied melody. I'm just speaking from my own personal like embodied experience. Mm. When there's an implied melody or an element, a melodic element or a chord progression is part of the construction of a song and then removed, that allows the listener to engage in the co-creation of a song in a way that will can potentially in the best possible circumstances create an investment in both listening to the song and kind of like relationship building to the music that is potentially like
it
magical,
yeah.
You know? And I wonder if that's part of what is going on here with part,
I think
maybe
I
partly
know.
With the success. I know that for me, I feel it,
yeah.
You know, and I feel it in other pieces that he's composed and by various artists that do something similar. It's not totally common. I'd say it's kind of an uncommon, particularly in pop music,
yeah.
It's pretty uncommon. Usually it's just piling more and more and more on so that you don't have to think or feel anything. You just basically just can...
Case in point, Shania Twain.
Yeah, can just die. Sure. Yeah, I didn't hear that song with you guys, but I imagine that that's true. I mean, a lot of pop music is basically just being like, I would like to be dead inside for 3 minutes, please.
Yeah.
Could you just facilitate that for me? You know, versus like, I'd like to subconsciously co-create this music with you. You
Prince
know, which
did that
which
so
what
often.
Happens here.
Little Red Corvette, when he would perform mm-hmm. that song live, he would have the audience clap along to the song. Now, I say that, and that sounds terrible, because it always sounds terrible.
Always.
When someone says, like, clap to this, like, you know, give us, like, do a clap motion, and then mm-hmm. you're clapping.
Mm-hmm.
This is, he was in, like, a big enough room that he knew what, he knows, it's like, it's not like he likes the sound of people clapping along to music.
Right.
He doesn't. Probably like that, or didn't probably like that. I'm not going to fall into this trap again. He didn't probably like that. What he liked is the part of Little Red Corvette that he programmed
mm-hmm.
that goes in the beat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he was like, he would be standing on the stage, and the band would start the like soft part of Little Red Corvette,
mm-hmm.
and he would not be having like anyone on the stage playing that part like very prominently.
Right.
But it's in the beat, and in order for him to hear it the way that he wanted to hear it, and also get the audience involved
mm-hmm.
in creating the song with him,
mm-hmm.
co-creating the song in their brains, he would have them clap that part. Specifically that part, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do it in a way that he's standing in a room full of 20,000 people, and he's looking around, and he's clapping like this, and he's like, he's doing the clap, clap, clap. And like, he's like trying to get the audience to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
20,000 people, he wants them mm-hmm. to get that correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he's trying to get them to get involved. He's not like hyping you up. He wants to hear that so that he can play a mellifluous guitar solo just because he's holding a guitar and he wants to start the song with one for some reason.
But that's an interesting, I mean, the fact that he even believes that 20,000 people could do that is interesting and kind of says something about him and says something about like the music that he was creating in its uncompromising nature and not feeling like, I mean, maybe it's a logical leap here, but I'm going to make it anyway. It's just like not feeling like he has to make it dumber or less interesting for the quote-unquote masses.
Totally.
You know? And so much of pop music or just basically what exists in media today and certainly at the time is just a constant, not just dumbing down, but talking down to people like, okay, here's the thing that you think you want.
Yeah.
We'll give it to you.
Well, what's funny about what that story you just told and what strikes me as potentially something metaphorical there is the willingness or desire or even necessity to manipulate his audience into doing it right. And that seems to be everything we're talking about, just into, or you guys are talking about, which about saying, you know, no, you're going to understand this. You're going to understand it. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. And I'll fucking wait until you do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll figure this out.
I mean,
out.
He knows best. For
and he's
sure.
like, you're my instrument. I mean, right. is he essentially thinking of an audience as an instrument that he can manipulate?
He totally
and
is.
That's the feeling he wants them to project, mm-hmm. is love for him
yeah.
or whatever. I mean, you could call that egomaniacal, I suppose, and probably part of it was, but there's a sense
where
he's like...
plenty of stories to confirm that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also something that you said, Spencer, which is just that, you know, their participation makes them love it more.
Of
and
course.
He probably knows
yeah.
that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's
I'm just
a gift.
Sitting,
that's a form of generosity in a way.
And I'm just sitting here, I'm just sitting there in the audience listening to the sound it makes
mm-hmm.
of the clapping in the room. And I'm like, yeah, that is a good production choice for this record, or like this like recording, quote unquote, of like a live performance of this song. And also to kind of wrap this up, to reference earlier, we talked about intimacy. As you mentioned intimacy,
I did.
Intimacy. Fletcher mentioned intimacy. The idea that I think that so many of his decisions are about creating that intimacy in the listener.
Yeah.
And I
even the way he mics his voice.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. I had a revelation as a person who makes music that where I sing on the songs that he sings as if he were in front of either 20,000 people or no one at the same time. Like his vocal style could be both, and it is both. And he doesn't change the way he sings in front of 20,000 people. He sings the same way on recording.
Right.
And I had that. I've just striving for that. Not that I'll ever strive to play in front of thousands of people, or 8,000 people, or 100 people.
Right.
What I'm getting at.
You've played for 100 people.
I play for 100 people. But you know what I'm saying? My point being, I want to strive for that.
Yeah.
That just the way to access that intimate and passionate performance style where it's personal and you are doing what you're doing because it sounds good in your head and it sounds good with what you're listening to and because it's going to sound good to no matter who is standing in front of you at any given moment when you're doing it.
Well, it's a phenomenally beautiful gesture.
Yeah.
You know, I think, I mean, I don't have a privileged perspective on reality, but I receive it that way, you know?
Yes.
And he, because, you know, I mean, if he's trying, like there, he's, it's putting the commune in communicate, you know what I mean? And just to think about, like, also going back to him making those sounds or getting everybody to clap along like that, it's like, I mean, going back to just calling him a male witch, like, or really, I mean, he's really actually a gender fluid witch,
right.
Which is even better, you know.
Way better.
May we all get there someday. I hope we do. But there is, I receive and am interested in the dimension of mysticism in his both creative practice, life, and music making. And there's something profoundly mystical about 20,000 people all clapping their hands in a certain way at the same time to like contribute to this, you know, to the beauty and power of this song.
To pop music.
Yeah, just as there is something like very, really legitimately mystical about having a silent, secret chord progression that is happening only in your imagination. It's happening in the song, but it's only happening in the song because it's also happening in your imagination.
And get this, the hook lyric, this is what it sounds like when doves cry.
Right, and he doesn't make the sound.
He's just saying it. He's creating another thing for you.
Right.
It's just so much possibility to create.
Mm-hmm.
He was, the last time I saw him, it was at the Oracle Arena.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him a few times.
Is that in Oakland?
Yeah.
That's where I saw him. I've only seen him once, but that's I saw him perform there in 2003, 2004.
On the Musicology tour, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I saw him do his last tour, mm-hmm. one of his last shows, piano and a microphone. And he it was just him with a piano in front of 20,000 people.
Yeah.
And he did truly, like, he triggered the When Doves Cry sound effect.
Yeah.
So, or, like, backing track. So he could, so he could sing it. Yeah. And he's like, oh, I never do, like, he's like, he was like, I never do this or whatever, you know. But then also, like, halfway through the show, he just looked up and he was like, how'd y'all get in my living room? Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not the quote. How'd my living room get so big? That was the line. Even better.
So yeah.
Amazing. How did my living room get so big?
Yeah.
That, I think, sums up in a nutshell.
Yeah, right, totally.
Awesome.
When Does Cry by Prince.
So
we're going to pick
up.
Yeah, this song sucks.
I know. Just listen to it as many times as you can until you die.
Listen to that song over and over again.
Happy
listen to
that
other,
it exists in the world.
Listen to other Prince songs. Listen to the
almost all of
Purple Rain box set that just came out. Listen to the Vault tracks. There's an 11-minute song on it called We Can Fuck. There's an 8-minute song on it called Possessed. You know, he was
listen
just
to
like
his first. Listen to his
nuts.
First two albums if you haven't heard them.
His first two albums are so great. Dirty Mind is a stone cold masterpiece. Yeah. Sign of the Times is a stone cold masterpiece. Yeah. He made more masterpieces than anyone has ever
we
made.
We can't list them all.
We're going to pick the next song on the next. No, we're going to pick it now.
We're going to pick it right now.
Okay. We're going to pick the next song right now.
So
Jalen's already drawing it.
I'm going to randomize this number right now. 197.
We're still in the early 80s. Okay, great. So this is 1981.
Takes us to 1981.
Yeah.
The 97th most popular song. I'm having trouble pulling up this page. We'll edit this out.
Hey, Fletcher.
Yes.
Can we mention again that you have a new album?
I don't know.
I think you should talk about it
bit. Great. Well, it's not Prince, but it's mystically informed, place-based drone folk eco drone music or something like that.
And it's informed by Prince because all of your
and
music
it's informed
is.
By Prince because every yeah, it definitely I guess it is all informed by Prince. I don't think he would know how, or and I certainly don't know how, but
right.
But it has to be.
Yeah.
Because I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of hours of his amazing music.
Yeah.
Yes, please go and listen to it or buy it on LP
Title?
Or cassette. It's called Cold Spring. And it's
on your record
label,
which is?
It's on my record label, which is GnomeLifeRecords.com. It's all recorded on tape in Big Sur, California, and got some deep Northern California weirdo vibes on it, so... Fencer did a great job too on it, and
the
Crickets, as I mentioned already, they're pretty good.
All right, we're ready.
We got a song. Okay, what is it?
So the 97th most popular song in the year 1981 is "7 Year Ache" by Roseanne Cash.
No idea what this song sounds like. I know she's a country artist. I don't know if this is a country song.
Well,
I don't know.
Can you repeat those specs again? The 97th most popular song
of 1981
is
7 Year Ache by Roseanne Cash. And this was, but can I just tell you a few of the things around this?
Yeah, please do.
Just because it's interesting. So this is just a few in the bottom 10 of 1981. For Your Eyes Only from the James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Beach Boys Medley by The Beach Boys.
What?
Whip
is that
It,
Kokomo?
I don't know. Whip It by Devo. I'm Coming Out by Diana Ross is one song under this.
One of my favorite songs of all time.
Boz Scaggs, and like it's a pretty crazy collection.
This is
it's
a weird year.
It's a strange year, 1981.
I think we're gonna find that every year is a little bit weird.
I hope that this song really tells us something about the year that we didn't necessarily remember or know.
We'll find out. Maybe it's gonna be Shania all over again. Who knows?